Confederate flags, Confederate icons, Confederate symbols of all sorts have been coming down all across these United States, even in the old Confederacy states, over the past several years. But recently, I noticed that a statue of a non-Confederate fellow was getting similar treatment. In fact, this was a statue of a fellow who served in the United States government before and during the Civil War on the United States Supreme Court, and yet he's become controversial. His name was Roger Taney, and he was the Chief Justice of the United States. He was also the chief author of an opinion called Dred Scott. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's about the most dreadful Chief Justice.
Stay tuned for your weekly constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law. And it's starting now.
Josh Blackman is a professor at the Houston College of Law who recently wrote a piece about a recent phenomenon that had come to my attention independently. It seems that a statue of a Chief Justice of the United States from the 19th century had been vandalized, and there was an ongoing discussion about whether it should come down completely. The Chief Justice in question is a fellow by the name of Roger Taney. Have you ever heard that name? Roger Taney was the author of perhaps the most infamous decision in the history of the Supreme Court, a decision called Dred Scott versus Sanford.
My name is Josh Blackman. I'm a constitutional law professor at the Houston College of Law. I also have a new book out that came out last week called The Unraveled, Obamacare, Religious Liberty, and Executive Power. I write broadly on constitutional law in the United States Supreme Court.
Well, that's just marvelous. And indeed, you posted recently on your blog very much about constitutional law, but about a subject that to many people is obscure, but strangely timely. And I saw something about that in the New York Times. So what was that blog post all about?
So my blog is joshblackman.com. And I recently wrote about an issue affecting a Chief Justice of the United States. His name was Roger Taney. And he was from Maryland. And there was a town in Maryland that has a bust, a statue of Chief Justice Taney. And there was a vigorous debate over whether the statue should be removed. Now, the name Roger Taney is probably most familiar to your listeners because of a single decision he wrote in the 1860s called Dred Scott v. Sanford.
Often cited as the worst decision in Supreme Court history. So, yeah, if you've heard of Roger Taney, that's probably what you've heard of.
Right. So the reason why this decision is so reviled is that it affected whether a slave, a guy by the name of Dred Scott, could become a citizen of the United States. The facts of the case are far less salacious than one might think. The facts were like this. There was a guy named Dred Scott who was a slave. His master transported him from the state of Missouri into what is today present-day Minnesota and Illinois, which was at the time free. And Scott sued in court saying that because my master traveled with me to a free state, I am now a free citizen. The idea is once a slave comes to free soil, then the slave becomes a free citizen.
That's a concept that many people haven't really thought about, but it was a problem all throughout the slaveholding era. You know, one group of states wants to have slavery, and they've said, you know, we're going to have slaves in our state. Another group of states decides it does not wish to have slavery. And so there was a real debate, a real pull and tug over the years about which state's law would prevail in such a circumstance. If I'm a slave state and I have slaves here, my position is that they are slaves no matter where they go in the country, and they eventually we can bring them back and they're going to remain slaves. But the position of if I'm a free state, my position is no, we don't allow slavery here. So any human being who's on our soil is by that nature, by that virtue of that fact, free. And this was a huge dividing line, and it came up frequently. So in some sense, this was not an unusual case, was it?
No. What made this unusual, though, is that Dred Scott didn't petition for his freedom while he was in what's today Illinois or Missouri. Mm-hmm. He only petitioned for his freedom later.
Right.
And what it actually, the law at the time in Missouri was that if you in fact are a slave and you go to a free state, you then become free. In a earlier version of this litigation, the Missouri Supreme Court reversed that decision, and they held that we no longer recognize that principle, that under Missouri law we now say that it doesn't matter where a slave goes, as long as he comes back to Missouri, we will not recognize his freedom. So that's what set up Dred Scott. The state courts, the Missouri Supreme Court, ruled against Mr. Scott. So Scott tried going to federal court to get a different ruling. And in the federal courts, one of the ways you can get in is when a citizen of one state sues a citizen of another state. By the time this case arose, Scott's master had, I think, died, and he was transferred to, I think it was Scott's brother or cousin who lived in New York.
Or that so was Sanford. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, Sanford. So what happened was Scott said, hey, look, I'm a citizen of Missouri. My master is a citizen of New York. Let me go to federal court and sue for my freedom because they were in different states.
Okay, Josh, I'm going to interrupt you again because I can't help myself now because in addition to constitutional law, I've taught civil procedure for the last 15 years. What we're talking about here, as you already have referenced, is a type of federal subject matter jurisdiction that is – federal courts can only hear cases that involve certain subjects. They've got limited jurisdiction. And as you've pointed out, one of those subjects is any case involving a citizen of state A versus a citizen of state B. So that was extremely important. This case really, in some sense, was all about jurisdiction. But in order for Dred Scott to get into federal court and to satisfy the requirements of so-called diversity jurisdiction, which had nothing to do with racial diversity but only diversity of citizenship between states, he had to allege, as you've said, that he was a citizen of the state of Missouri. Okay, so now we understand what procedurally why he was doing that. What happened?
Right. So even though this is such a momentous case about slavery, at bottom it boils down to rather mundane principles of civil procedure.
Mm-hmm.
Was Dred Scott a citizen of Missouri?
Are you calling civil procedure mundane?
I love civil procedure, okay. But it's not nearly as sexy as some people make it out to be. I like it.
You're right. Go on.
So what happened was this case goes to the Supreme Court, and a majority of the court ruled that in this instance, Scott was not a citizen. And because he was not a citizen, then he cannot use the federal courts. And in an early draft of the Dred Scott decision, another justice, not Taney, wrote a fairly narrow decision saying basically, well, he's not a citizen, therefore we don't have any jurisdiction over this case. Case dismissed.
I have to interrupt you again, Josh. That's what should have happened. If in fact there was no jurisdiction here, the rule is that the case is void ab initio, which is a fancy Latin way of saying it never should have been brought, and we're not going to decide anything except the jurisdictional issue. So you're telling me that there was a draft of this case that did it that way?
Exactly.
Wow.
It basically said he wasn't a citizen, dismissed. But that's not how it turned out. So Roger Taney, who was the Chief Justice, he was the Chief Justice that came after John Marshall from your home Commonwealth. And Taney basically said, look, this is not the way to resolve this case. There's this massive sectional conflict over slavery. And if we dump this case on jurisdictional grounds, it will come right back to us in a different form, right? Maybe it'll be an appeal from a state court. Maybe it'll be some other type of appeal. So Taney had the vision or the idea that we need to resolve this issue once and for all. We cannot do this sort of half measure jurisdictional dismissal. So Taney then went ahead and wrote a fairly lengthy opinion. The opinion, I think it's over 100 pages in the U.S. report. In fact, mm-hmm. parts of it were even edited out because it was so awful. He wrote this decision which said not only was Scott not a citizen, but that people of African descent could never be citizens, mm-hmm. ever, even if they were emancipated by their state or even if they were born free. Don't forget that in many northern states, slavery had already been illegal for some time. And you had free blacks who were able to vote and own property and everything else. Taney said that because of the differences in the races, these blacks could never, ever, ever be citizens of the United States. They can never have what are called privileges and immunities, these certain rights given by the Constitution, that they were never able to be full citizens. And then he kept going. He didn't stop there. Mm. He even made the point that because slavery was a form of property, it would actually violate the Due Process Clause of the Constitution to take away a person's slaves.
Before we get there, and you're right, that's an essential other point, He was essentially saying, in fact, said so pretty much so many words, these people are not human beings, they are property.
Yes.
They are property, yes, by definition. And that crystallized the whole institution of slavery. It's the denial of the humanity of people. But here was the Chief Justice of the United States speaking for a majority of the court, declaring that. What year was Dred Scott decided in?
1857.
1857. So this is, in some sense, on the eve of the Civil War. I would submit it's actually, the Civil War's already started in Kansas and Nebraska. I mean, there's already blood being shed between the pro and anti-slavery forces out in Kansas and Nebraska. So the violence has already begun, and this is like lighting a great big match and throwing it onto something, onto this pile.
Taney did not view it that way. He was actually trying to resolve the Kansas-Nebraska-Missouri Compromise debate. He was trying to resolve it. So the second part of his opinion, which I was on my way to, discusses whether the Missouri Compromise was even legal.
Okay, first, what was the Missouri Compromise?
The Missouri Compromise was a compromise reach that said if you are a new state that's above a certain latitude, right, which basically runs through Missouri, you will be a free state. If you're below that latitude, you'll be a slave state. And this was this sort of sectional agreement Congress reached to try and forestall what became the Civil War. Taney said that was unconstitutional. And the way he did it was frankly stunning. He first said that because blacks were property, it violated the Due Process Clause to deprive slave owners of their property, right?
Oh, my.
That it would actually, people had a vested property right to own these slaves, and for the government to pass this compromise saying, okay, if you're north of this line, you can't hold slaves, it's actually a deprivation of property without due process of law.
Good heavens. And so not only does he deny the humanity of Dred Scott, he actually finds another constitutional provision, plugs in the concept of property, and says, oh, the people who are really being constitutionally harmed here are the slave owners.
Yes, yes. And it goes even further. It's a remarkable opinion. He also held that Congress lacks the authority to control the territories. There's a clause in the Constitution called the Property Clause, which people never read, but it says that Congress has the power to dispose of its own property. And generally, this is how, you know, you have a national park, you have federal office buildings. This is the provision that allows Congress to manage its own property. What Taney held, and this was perhaps the most, I mean, it's a lot of stunning, but this was the most bizarre part of his opinion, is that that property clause only applies to property held at the time of the ratification of the Constitution in 1789. It does not apply to any property obtained subsequently. So as a result, Congress has no power over what were then called the Northwest Territories, like in Minnesota and you know, that area.
Or even the Louisiana Purchase. I mean, any of that stuff.
No, I mean, well, that was slaves. So that wasn't even the problem. But he said that the Northwest Territories, which which became modern-day Minnesota, for example,
right?
Congress has no power. So Congress would not only violate the rights of the slaveholders to take away their property in Minnesota, but Congress lacked the power to do it, period. So it's both a structural and a rights-based approach of why Congress could not get rid of slavery vel non. It's a stunning opinion, and most people mention it, and they have no idea what it actually says. But if you take the time to read it and work your way through it, there's so much going on there to try and develop this principle that the Constitution, protects slavery in all of its manifest attributes.
And so he concludes that the Missouri Compromise, which at that point had been in effect for decades, and one of the main things that was papering over the differences between the slave states and the free states, it's all of a sudden invalid.
Well, it may have been invalidated by the court, but it's far less clear if anyone actually listened to him. Mm-hmm. Subsequent to the Dred Scott decision, a young politician by the name of Abraham Lincoln made his national prominence based on Dred Scott. And in a series of debates when he was running for senator from Illinois against Stephen Douglas, these are the famous Lincoln-Douglas debates.
Right.
Lincoln effectively said that Dred Scott decision was wrong and it need not be complied with, and that just because five justices said something, that doesn't mean we have to follow it. And I mean, Lincoln was elected a couple years later as president, and the rest is history.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Houston College of Law professor Josh Blackman, all about a fellow you might not have heard of. His name is Roger B. Taney. He was Chief Justice of the United States and the chief author of perhaps the worst decision in constitutional history. After the break, we'll come back and speak some more with Josh Blackman. Stick around.
I'm a man. I spell M.
It's time again for the constitutional quiz, and with me is the quiz guy, Doug Smith.
Hey, Stuart, how are you?
I'm doing very well. What do you got for us this week?
Hey, Stuart, how's your wife?
Well, my wife is fine. How's your wife?
Sweetest woman on the planet. Your wife right after mine. Honey, I love you.
Yeah, we both love our wives. We're great guys.
Yeah. Well, I'm asking that because this week it's all about a wife. A wife. Here's the question. What is the minimal age set by the U.S. Constitution for marriage?
The minimal age set by the U.S. Constitution for marriage.
That's
that
right.
is a tough one. That is a tough one. What are the choices?
So it's not how old, but how young can you be to be married based
okay.
on the U.S. Constitution? So here's answer number one, 21, until the 26th Amendment that changed it to 18, similar to voting.
I see. Okay, that's answer choice A.
B, 14 years old.
Really?
Yeah, well, think about it. The Wild West, heading west,
okay,
younger and
okay.
younger ones.
Well, I guess so, yeah.
C, 19, unless a citizen's birth state constitution supersedes with a younger age.
Oh, so a citizen could have a state constitution that lets the person marry at a younger age is what that answer choice suggests.
If the state constitution supersedes the U.S. Supreme.
Okay.
In fact. And then D, it does not specify an age.
Okay, so four choices. What's the minimal age set by the U.S. Constitution? We got 21, 14, 19, and no specified minimum. Do we have a contestant?
Yes, we do. Shauna from South Carolina.
Shauna from South Carolina. And what do you think about this?
Well, first of all, Shauna, are you married?
Yes, I am, to Christopher, and he's here to help me.
He's Googling.
I did not want to get it wrong.
I see. Okay. Well, it's appropriate. A married person should have some help on this one. Okay. Well, do you have any proposed answer to this quiz?
Well, I was thinking 14, but you have to have parental consent with that one. So I'm going to guess 19. And what do you think, Chris? He's saying it doesn't specify.
Oh, so your husband doesn't think there is an age.
Yeah, and I think I'm going to say 19.
Well, hold on. We got conflicting answers here. We got a married couple with conflicting answers. Which one are we supposed to go with? Was your final answer?
Okay, which one are we going to go with our final answer? We're going to say, okay, I'm going to go with him, which I'm sure he's wrong, but
Okay, you're sure your husband's wrong, but you're going to back away and let him give the answer.
And what's your husband's name again?
His name is Chris. Say hi, Chris.
Hello.
So, Chris, you're going to be the one, you're going to be the man of the house on this one and answer the question?
Absolutely.
I hope you're right, buddy.
Okay, so we're going to go with it doesn't specify, even though I think 19, but he's saying it doesn't specify.
Well, I'm not just saying this because I'm a dude and I'm in solidarity with Chris, but it actually does not specify.
Oh, he's right? Oh, wow.
Oh, boy. Yeah, Chris, I don't know whether to congratulate you or say that you're in trouble, my friend.
This is one of the many instances where states actually legislate this kind of practice. They get to decide how old you are. In fact, it used to be that states decided how old you would be even to vote. But now that has been, that's been really consolidated at the federal level. Everybody recognizes 18 now. But state to state, you could have different ages and you could have different tests or procedures that you have to go by in order to get a marriage license. But Chris, you're right. The U.S. Constitution doesn't delve into that, doesn't legislate, and it does not specify.
Thank you. Well, congratulations. Oh, you got it right. Now, here's the next question. Okay. You only get one shirt, so who gets the shirt?
Well, I guess I'll give him my shirt.
You're going to give him your shirt? How come?
I'll get the shirt and give it to him.
She's going to give him the shirt off of her back.
Yeah. He won, well, but I'll take the shirt and give it to him.
That's love for you. Well, tremendous. And congratulations to both of you for winning it. In fact, I don't know. Maybe we'll give him two shirts. What do you think, Doug?
You know, they are from South Carolina. So.
Okay, we'll give him two shirts.
Good folks from South,
South Carolina. Thanks very much for playing the constitutional quiz.
Thank you for having us.
Well, thanks, Doug.
Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
Dressed on not traveling. His whole case was madness. Sued for his freedom. South Maxie a freeman. Argued that he was really free, but they didn't let Dred Scott be. Trial in St. Louis Old Courthouse. Supreme Court determined no Negro could be free. He was free, and so was his spouse. Dred Scott, life so short he didn't get a degree. It's their choice to let you rot. Cannot hear your silent scream. Cannot raise the moral steam. Refuse a so-called right. Justice blind to freedoms like all right. All right. All right.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Josh Blackman of the Houston College of Law, all about Chief Justice Roger Taney, who wrote the decision in Dred Scott versus Sanford, perhaps the most infamous decision in Supreme Court history. Before the break, Josh was telling me that Abraham Lincoln was no fan of this decision, and that he'd actually suggested that maybe we didn't need to accept it.
Well, I'll give a little bit of history here. The notion that John Marshall invented judicial review in Marbury versus Madison in 1803 is a myth. It had existed in English courts for centuries beforehand.
It had been it had been stated in Marbury versus Madison.
Yeah,
and even if there were precedent,
even with a federal 78, Hamilton talks about judicial review. So
sure.
Marshall, I realize you're in Virginia, but he gets far too much credit. I'm not a Marshall fan. But the general principle
But that's a whole nother subject now, Josh. I mean, we understood that judicial review existed in this country even as of the time of the Lincoln-Douglas debates.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But the court is not the only branch that takes an oath to the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
The president takes an oath to the Constitution to take care of the laws are faithfully executed.
Yeah.
I say this to my students almost every class. The Supreme Court does not have a monopoly on the Constitution. And the mere fact that five justices write a decision does not mean that's the law. And I know that's jarring to people who have this sort of court-focused, centered view of the law, but they're not the only actors in our constitutional discourse. And I think Lincoln articulated fairly effectively that the court does not have the final say. And what overturned Dred Scott was the Battle of Lee v. Grant.
Mm-hmm.
What overturned Dred Scott was the ratification of the 14th Amendment. It wasn't a judicial decision. It wasn't five justices. It was the people themselves in the bloodshed at Antietam. I mean, this is how constitutional discourse works. We fought a war over a constitutional ideal, and we passed three amendments to the Constitution over a constitutional ideal, triggered by a decision from Justice Taney.
Well, I'm not going to dispute you on that one. I mean, that's certainly true. The Supreme Court opined in a certain way, and they did it an extraordinarily important case and an extraordinarily important issue. And this is the one time when you can say that judicial review did not resolve an issue. In fact, just the opposite happened. It was resolved by the sword.
Yeah. You know, judicial review usually doesn't resolve disputes. People have this, again, court-centric view of the world. Like Brown versus Board of Education did not desegregate schools. Roe v. Wade did not legalize abortions. Pick any decision that you think made a big deal and something else actually did it. People think too much of the courts. I say this as a common law professor, but most actual disputes are resolved by the political process or perhaps war, not by five justices.
Well, again, I'll agree with you in a theoretical sense that the court only has as much power as society chooses to give it.
Sure.
And that it's not in the sense of resolving the entire abortion debate. Roe versus Wade didn't resolve it. You're right. People are still protesting out in front of the Supreme Court every January. And there are still attempts to get the decision overturned. And there are still attempts to limit it and regulate abortion in all sorts of ways. So I'm going to agree with you on this.
Cool.
I will suggest, though, that your opinion of judicial review, would you agree that it's a minority opinion?
I don't know. Probably. I think people.
That, I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm simply saying that I think the general consensus is, at least among people who are con law nerds, is that by and large, five votes on the Supreme Court does, at least in a de jure sense, in a legal sense, in a constitutional sense, resolve an issue, even if it leaves schools effectively segregated, even if there are still strong opinions on abortion. You know, most people will say whatever five justices of the court say is effectively constitutional law, or effectively what the Constitution means. And so I sense that your position on the issue of judicial review is probably not the majority position.
No, probably not.
Okay,
although
well, that's okay.
I think if you look at history, it bears out that five votes doesn't do everything.
And I'll certainly agree with you. It certainly did not in Dred Scott.
No, not even close.
Not even close. In fact, it's you might call this the single biggest failure of judicial review.
Probably not. No.
You don't think so?
No. I think a case like Korematsu is actually far worse.
That's a bad case.
Probably. I think Korematsu is far worse because you had a situation where the government was actively lying to the court and the court simply looked the other way. Yeah. I think in Dred Scott, I tell this to my students, but the holding that Scott was not a citizen for purpose of diversity jurisdiction probably was correct. I mean, it's a closer call than the court made it seem, but that's not a totally erroneous decision at the time based on law. The rest of Tanya's decision went absolutely insane.
Okay, hold on just a second, Jessica, because I'm going to agree with you here. As a pure matter of constitutional law, set morality aside, set justice aside, set equality certainly aside, it was almost certainly correct that a slave could not be considered a citizen pretty much for any purpose, but certainly not for the purposes of diversity jurisdiction, because slaves were in fact property rather than being considered human beings. But we have to point something out. The word equality was not in the Constitution yet.
The first
time that occurred was in Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, which was not ratified till after the war.
Yeah.
And so that, in a purely legal sense, so I want to clarify that so that nobody listening thinks that either you or I thought this was in some sense a just decision or a good decision. It's purely as a matter of technical constitutional analysis that it was probably correct. And if they'd written that very limited opinion that you've told me about, simply dismissing this on jurisdictional grounds, it probably would be fairly unremarkable.
Yeah, you can read the concurring decision. I think it's Justice Nelson, I might be forgetting his name, but there's a concurring decision that makes the point much more narrowly. But as a matter of straight up principles of jurisdiction, there probably wasn't jurisdiction in that case. People don't like when I say that, but it's probably right.
It probably is right. In fact, let's even say something else here. Chief Justice Taney, with the exception, the notable exception of this opinion, is generally considered to be a good Chief Justice, isn't he?
Well, minority view here, right?
You're not going to agree with me on anything, are you? That's always been my impression, is that people will say that he was actually fairly respected. He was considered to be a good jurist. He is a guy who knew his stuff.
Right. So the other decision, the one that he's perhaps most famous for, also involves Abraham Lincoln. And it's a case that was triggered during the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And the facts of the case were like this. During the Civil War, there was a soldier who was held at Fort McHenry, which is in Baltimore. And yeah. that was a Union fort. And there was a soldier being held there. And this soldier petitioned for what's known as habeas corpus, right? He basically asked a court to say, hey, I'm being held without being charged. You know, can you judge, you know, let me out or figure out what's going on? And through a procedure that is frankly not even well understood today, that petition got to Roger Taney somehow. He was the justice who had supervisory duties over Maryland, which was his home state. Mm-hmm. How it got to Taney again, it's actually somewhat unclear. It's weird. But it got to Taney. And Taney basically said, okay, you know, Union Army, you're holding this guy Merriman. You haven't charged him with anything. You know, I want you to come to court and explain why you're detaining this guy. And the general who was in charge of that base basically ignored it and said, you know, we're in the middle of a war. I'm not letting him go. So then Taney issued a subsequent decision where he basically said, you go tell Mr. Lincoln, right, that you can't ignore courts. And what happens after that is somewhat hazy because there's various conflicting accounts. But the uncontroverted part is after Taney said, you need to come produce some evidence of why you're hung this guy, tell Mr. Lincoln about it, nothing was done. And they again ignored the justice's orders. So this is a tangible example of courts simply ignoring a judicial order. Tangible.
Wow.
This is, rumor is that Lincoln knew about it. Again, it's hazy, but the short answer is nothing was ever done. So here we had a situation where Taney was trying to actually vindicate the civil rights of a white guy, but someone who was being held by the Union Army, and the executive branch simply flipped him off.
Right.
This is another decision I often raise from Taney to say that, you know, there are other aspects of his jurisprudence that were commendable.
Yeah, people will often note that, generally speaking. That's a very interesting case, though, of course, because today we have an ongoing debate over whether and to what extent the federal judiciary has any business intervening in what are perceived to be purely executive and purely military matters. And so we have, you know, the big issue with Guantanamo, et cetera. Now, we've had some recent cases there where the judiciary actually has stepped up and has said that, at least in certain circumstances, that habeas relief is available to people who are being held at places like Guantanamo. In other words, at the very least, if the military might be called into an Article III court to justify why it's holding someone. So that's an ongoing dispute. I think what we don't have today is the president simply ignoring the courts.
Yeah. I mean, Lincoln was good at that. He didn't respect much judicial decisions. I mean, very famously, Lincoln, during the Civil War, suspended the writ of habeas corpus. Means he did not want to have to defend any people that he captured. The Constitution says that only Congress can suspend the writ of habeas corpus. Congress subsequently ratified that decision, but Lincoln—we could do another call sometime on Lincoln—but he had very idiosyncratic views of constitutional law, not the least of which was concerning judicial review.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic. In fact, I'm going to be doing a show in the very near future here on Abraham Lincoln and his view of the Constitution. It's a subject that I'm fascinated by and I don't know nearly enough about. But I guess the general justification that I've understood that the people will use in Lincoln's defense is that he was literally sitting in a capital city that was surrounded by slave states. And that he felt at any moment that he could be attacked from the rear. He had been under threat of assassination pretty much since the moment he'd been elected. And the existence of the country was at stake. And so in that circumstance, if there's any justification for all the stuff Lincoln did, it was survival. That he had a duty, his highest duty under his oath was to make sure that the nation existed. Now that's obviously a justification that can be misused and can destroy the very fabric of the Constitution itself, but that's always what I've heard.
Yeah, I mean, he gave a number of speeches about the House divided cannot stand, and how to save the nation, he would have to, you know, read the Constitution in a way that had not been read before.
Yeah.
Lincoln was an attorney. He argued cases before, I think at least one or maybe two cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. He had very pronounced views on constitutional law, and the times where he found himself in did not allow him to give much credence to an independent judiciary, especially if it was to frustrate his ability to prevent the dissolution of the Union.
Yeah, that was his position. And he did have an argument. You pointed out that Congress subsequently ratified his suspension of habeas corpus. Well, in those days, Congress wasn't in more or less continuous session. Lincoln was pretty much on his own for a month at a time. And so he did lots of things, I think, especially early in the war, knowing full well that he was likely to be criticized for acting outside the Constitution, and just counted on them showing up later and ratifying him, because of course by that time all the Democrats, or at least all the Southern Democrats, had left. And that's ultimately what ended up happening. But we've diverged here into a fascinating area that's taking us a little bit away from Dred Scott, and that's fine. But let's go back and talk about Chief Justice Taney and how this decision was received after he penned it. What happened?
Well, this is how we jumped off target. Lincoln and others were very vigorous in rejecting the legitimacy of this decision. And for years afterwards, Judge Taney's opinion in Dred Scott was viewed as the worst of the worst, because not only did it reached the wrong conclusion about this, about the Missouri Compromise and everything. But also it to use your phrase, lit a match and perhaps, if not caused, accelerated the sectional conflict that led to the Civil War. And debates over Taney began very early on. There was a debate in 1865 over whether the Congress should commission a bust to commemorate Roger Taney. And there was this great floor speech that involved Charles Sumner of Massachusetts and Lyman Trumbull, and these were both Reconstruction senators. And basically, I got the quote here, Charles Sumner said, "I object that now an emancipated country should make a bust to the author of Dred Scott." Lyman Trumbull said, "Well, you know, even if he made a wrong decision, he was still a great and learned man." Then Sumner replied, "Let me tell the senator that the name Taney is to be hooted down the pages of history. Judgment's beginning now, and an emancipated country will fasten upon him the stigma which he deserves." So even in 1865, you know, a couple years, you know, after the Civil War, you know, was winding down or wound down, we already had this vigorous debate of how to remember Justice Taney.
Understandably, but we have to point out that Senator Sumner was also a fellow who had a particular grievance against the South.
Well,
he had been beaten on the floor of the Senate by a Southern representative just a few years earlier when there had been a dispute over over these very issues.
Yeah. If you see the movie Lincoln, they depict Sumner in a very, played by Tommy Lee Jones in a curious way. Mm-hmm. There was this vigorous debate. So in the state of Maryland, which is Taney's home state, they built a bust to him in Frederick. That was his hometown. Mm-hmm. And there's now been an ongoing series of votes about whether or not to keep the bust of Taney. About a year or two ago, some vandals poured a bucket of red paint over the bust. Also relevant is that in the U.S. Supreme Court, in the great, you know, the grand entrance when you walk in, they have busts along the wall of each of the chief justices. Mm-hmm. And there is indeed a bust of Roger Taney in the Supreme Court. So now many, you know, activist groups are saying that this bust should come down, that we should not be honoring and celebrating the Chief Justice who wrote this Dred Scott decision. And you're actually seeing in certain towns that the Taney busts are going away, you know, maybe put in a museum or something, but they're not going to leave it on state property.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Josh Blackman, a professor at the Houston College of Law, and we're talking about the most infamous or perhaps the most dreadful Chief Justice in American history. After the break, we'll come back and finish our discussion with Josh Blackman. Stick around.
I'm a man.
Yeah!
I spell him H-I. But a man, I'm a full grown man. I'm a man, I'm a rolling stone. I'm a man.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Josh Blackman of the Houston College of Law about a historic subject, the Dred Scott decision and the Chief Justice, Roger Taney, who wrote it, but also a very modern situation, because it seems that various statues and busts of Roger Taney that have been erected around the country are now under attack.
Yeah, and my views on this are somewhat nuanced.
Mm-hmm.
If we start to remove monuments of people that we judge by today's standards as being, you know, unacceptable, we're going to have to do a lot of sandblasting in the National Mall. It's unfortunate that the only thing people know about Thomas Jefferson is that he owned slaves and had relations with slaves. That's all people know. He did amazing things, the Statue of Religious Freedom, the Declaration of Independence, founding the University of Virginia. I'm reading off his headstone now.
Right.
He did some pretty amazing things in his life. But if we say that because he was a slave owner and because he held slaves and, you know, had relations with slaves, that we have to we can't honor in place of prominence. You walk on the list: Madison, Jefferson, Washington, George Mason. You know, I went to law school with George Mason. A lot of the greatest figures in early history did stuff that by today's standards were awful. Forgetting about slavery, think about gender. I mean, how many of them let their wives work, or you know, had their wives any place of prominence in society? The answer is basically none of them. The other point that I like to make is that Taney was not alone in saying things that by today's standards are awful. And if I can go back to one of my figures I mentioned earlier, good old John Roberts, not John Roberts, John Marshall. I often get confused, unfortunately, too much Obamacare. Chief Justice Marshall wrote a decision called Johnson versus McIntosh, a decision that most people never even read. The case involved whether Indians, you know, Indian tribes, could sell land. And Marshall wrote this pretty awful opinion saying that Indians were not civilized people, that they were these savages who were incapable of contracting property. Therefore, any property that they conveyed is utterly and completely void. They can't do it. And, I mean, the opinion calls them these savages. We have to protect from them. I mean, it's pretty awful language for reasons that never fully were obvious to me. People give Marshall a pass because I think people like him. But he wrote some pretty odious things by today's standards. Mm-hmm. Another one, which your listeners may be surprised at, is John Marshall Harlan, who's an icon of mine. He wrote the famous dissent in Plessy versus Ferguson,
right,
that separate is not equal. And this is a part that, you know, people celebrate this decision, but no one reads to the very end. No one reads to the very end. If you go to the second to last paragraph in the opinion, he has this entire riff about how Chinese people can never be citizens, that they're foreign and alien to our culture, that perhaps blacks can be citizens, but Chinese people can't, that they're always loyal to the emperor. I mean, this is some pretty, you know, awful stuff. I can go down the list.
You mentioned Korematsu, and though he was not on the court at the time, a very strong supporter of the Korematsu decision and of Japanese incarceration generally, was Earl Warren.
He was the governor of California.
Yes,
he was one locking people up. He complied with Russell's orders. I mean, I can go on. You have some pretty awful things that justices have done. And then for one reason or another, maybe because people have short attention spans, they focus on Taney. But I can write a list really long of justices who have said and done things that by today's standards are awful. And if our response is simply to strike them out of the, you know, the place of prominence and forget all the other things that they did, you know, Hugo Black was a justice. He was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Mm-hmm. He was a Klansman.
He later tried to justify that by saying that it was just the thing to do at the time, and that he never really harbored those opinions. But that rings rather hollow, doesn't it?
Yeah, give me a break. You know,
He did become a leading advocate for civil rights when he was an associate justice on the Supreme Court, and some people speculate it was as a matter of atonement. In fact, some people speculate that Earl Warren, when he got to be Chief Justice, was such an ardent advocate for civil rights because he felt ashamed of the way he had acted during the Korematsu affair.
Well, maybe we'll give forgiveness. One of my favorite examples to give is that in a famous case called Mueller against Oregon, this was whether there could be a minimum wage law, a maximum hour law for women. Louis Brandeis, who became a famous justice, wrote this brief where he basically wrote that women need extra protection from the state because they're so weak. And he had all this junk science. It said if women work too hard, their uteruses will fall out. I mean, you know.
That would be painful.
Yeah, and false. The simple point is, if we start putting a magnifying glass to all these historical figures, which I've done, you dig up a lot of stuff that's awful. But for one reason or another, Taney has had this odious aura attached to him because of the decision he wrote in Dred Scott. Maybe because it's easy. Maybe because, like, you know, it's simple. Oh, yeah, Dred Scott, slavery, Civil War. People can think about it conceptually. But if we try to be consistent, which I try to do, maybe not always, but I try, we're going to have to do a lot of sandblasting. And a lot of monuments will become hollow.
But, you know, the good part of that would be that then there would be space for monuments to you and to me.
Oh, I don't want a monument.
But, I mean, there are very few very perfect people on this planet. And so, I mean, that would be kind of nice to have a monument, wouldn't it?
Nah, I don't want a monument to myself.
You don't want a monument?
No. It's too effacing.
Hey, before we leave Chief Justice Taney, when you read his name, it looks like Taney, T-A-N-E-Y. And in fact, I must admit that mentally I pronounced it Taney for many years, and yet consistently everyone will tell you, no, it's Tawny. How do we know that? Have you ever looked into how we know how he pronounced it? There were obviously no sound recordings back then.
You know, I'm actually not sure. That's been the received wisdom, and I think people are pronouncing that for decades. Maybe actually a family name that people still bear.
That's probably it. It has to be that people who are descendants of his pronounce it Tawny, and therefore it's just never left, you know, human memory.
But even though we don't have sound recordings, at the time, people who took dictation were actually able to put down in their dictation the inflection and accents. So although we don't have a recording of the Gettysburg Address, because the way it was transcribed, we actually know how Lincoln inflected his voice at various junctures. So they were able to capture pronunciation with the former shorthand that existed at the time.
Well, then, maybe that's how it's come down through the ages. But one of these days, I'll track down somebody who'll tell me definitively why we pronounce it Tawny rather than Taney. Minor point. Any other thoughts on this before we leave our interview today?
No, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Well, Josh, I appreciate your time, too. This has been fascinating, and it's obviously very timely in an unexpected sort of way. So thanks very much. And did you want to plug your unrelated book? You wrote a book on Obamacare, you said.
Unrelated? What a good plug. The title of the book is Unraveled, Obamacare, Religious Liberty, and Executive Power. It's on sale on Amazon now.
On sale on Amazon now. And, of course, what's your blog again?
The blog is joshblackman.com.
And how do you spell Blackman?
Exactly how it sounds. B-L-A-C-K-M-A-N.
Okay, not M-O-N-M-A-N. Okay, well, Josh Blackman of the University of Houston?
The Houston College of Law.
Houston College of Law, which I'm guessing is in Houston, Texas?
It is.
Okay, thanks very much for being on the show. We appreciate you.
Thank you, sir.
And now it's time for this week's Stat Quote with Library Ann.
Today's edition of Stat Quotes discusses a controversial issue. The issue is whether medical marijuana is legal to possess and use. Many of you may be thinking that marijuana is legal in some states, and you would be right. Others may be thinking that medical marijuana continues to be prosecuted by the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration, and you would also be right. So the issue of whether medical marijuana is indeed legal becomes one waiting for a constitutional court challenge. For regular listeners of the Weekly Constitutional, you will recognize this issue as one under the U.S. Constitution's Supremacy Clause, which provides that all laws made in furtherance of the Constitution are the supreme law of the land and enjoy legal superiority over any conflicting provision of a state law. The current federal law in effect, the Controlled Substances Act, was enacted in 1970 under Richard Nixon. The act prohibits the manufacture, distribution, dispensation, and possession of marijuana, in addition to many other drugs. If you think back to what was happening in the early 1970s, our troops were returning from Vietnam, and illegal drug use was on the rise. The federal law was enacted to curtail illegal drug use and strengthen existing law enforcement authority in the field of drug abuse. All good things. In 1970, marijuana was classified as a Schedule I drug, or a controlled substance that has a high potential for abuse, with no current accepted medical use and a lack of accepted safety for the use of the drug under medical supervision. Other drugs in this category include heroin, codeine, and morphine. In 1970, the federal law was enforced by DEA agents trying to slow the rise of illegal drug use and international drug trafficking into the United States, primarily from Mexico, where marijuana is one of the largest sources of revenue for Mexican cartels. Fast forward to 1996, when California became the first state to legalize the use of medical marijuana. The Compassionate Use Act, or Proposition 215, was approved by 56% of voters to legalize cannabis for the treatment of cancer, anorexia, AIDS, chronic pain, spasticity, glaucoma, arthritis, migraine headaches, or any other illness for which marijuana provides relief. The law removed the state's criminal penalties for medical marijuana use, possession, and cultivation, and permits possession of an amount sufficient for a patient's personal medical purposes. As the legalization of medical marijuana has evolved, there have been some setbacks. Think about the proximity of California to Mexico, or the likely distribution channel that California offers Mexico for the illegal drug market into the United States. Think about how the Department of Justice is committed to prosecuting traffickers of illegal drugs. This creates a perfect storm where state statutes that legalize medical marijuana are in violation of federal law, and this conflict permits the DEA to investigate and arrest medical marijuana providers and users in states where it is, quote, legal, unquote. In a 2005 U.S. Supreme Court decision, Gonzalez v. Raich, two patients and two caregivers in California sued the DEA for enforcing the Controlled Substances Act over California's Compassionate Use Act. They argued that applying the federal law to a situation where medical marijuana was being grown and used in accordance with state laws exceeded Congress's constitutional authority under the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause allows the federal government to regulate interstate commerce. However, the justices found that Congress's power to regulate commerce extends to purely local activities that are part of an economic class of activities that have a substantial effect on interstate commerce. As long as medical marijuana is not sold, transported across state lines, or used for non-medical purposes, states should be free to adopt medical marijuana laws. But this decision did not address the larger issue of changing how marijuana is characterized as a Schedule I drug, instead of a Schedule II drug, which would recognize the medical uses of marijuana. The court concluded that medicinal marijuana was indistinguishable from the recreational marijuana Congress intended to regulate. Moreover, the Supreme Court held that California's law permitting the use of marijuana for medicinal purposes could not be the basis for placing the activity beyond the reach of the federal government due to the Supremacy Clause. Currently, 23 states and Washington, D.C. have legalized marijuana for either medicinal or recreational use, or both. With nearly half of the states legalizing some form of marijuana use, the federal government has backed off a bit on enforcement. In a 2009 memorandum from the Office of the United States Deputy Attorney General, the distribution of marijuana in the U.S. remains the single largest source of revenue for Mexican cartels. However, the 2009 memorandum took strides to focus federal law enforcement actions on those individuals who unlawfully market and sell marijuana for profit and away from the individuals who use or distribute marijuana as part of a recommended treatment regime consistent with applicable state law and under medical supervision. More recently, several congressional bills have been introduced and sought to give states the legal freedom to form their own drug policies, usually consistent with how those states regulate the use of alcohol. These bills usually suggest changing the classification of marijuana from a Schedule I drug to a Schedule II drug. While Schedule II drugs are still considered to have a high potential for abuse, the drugs on the list have a current accepted medical use with severe restrictions. Moving medical marijuana to a Schedule II drug would also make authorized users and growers exempt from federal prosecution as long as they are acting in accordance with state laws. Getting back to the Commerce Clause issue, now we have data to suggest that legalizing marijuana for recreational use might be good for the economy. Two states, Colorado and Washington, legalized marijuana for recreational use in 2014. Colorado set a tax rate of 29%, which is equivalent to the tobacco products and nearly four times the tax on alcohol or other ordinary goods and services in the state. Washington's tax rate of 44% is about half the tax rate of cigarettes, but four times the beer tax and other ordinary goods and services. As a side note, the federal government used to tax marijuana. In 1937, there was a Marijuana Tax Act that eventually led to the Controlled Substances Act of 1970. Today's stat quote comes from a book by Rudolf Gerber entitled Legalizing Marijuana, Drug Policy Reform and Prohibition Politics. Our government's marijuana crusade certainly teaches lessons and models behaviors. The lessons and models come more from Machiavelli and the Three Stooges than from any principled policy inspiring citizen allegiance. This is Library Ann with the Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law with today's stat quote.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Josh Blackman of the Houston College of Law, who told us all about that fascinating and dreadful Chief Justice, Roger B. Taney. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. And our stack quotes is by Ann Walsh Long of the Duncan School of Law at Lincoln Memorial University. Of course, we know her better as Library Ann. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.